I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So here's the thing that happens in my brain. I look at the calendar and I see it's June. And I go, oh, hey, it's summer. And now suddenly I'm ready for tomatoes and watermelon and corn. Well, where I live, I won't see tomatoes and watermelon and corn for, what, another 6 weeks? So isn't it weird when seasons are defined by the calendar and not, say, by the actual seasons? So we got to thinking, not what summer looks like, but what does June look like and taste like across the country? What's it like in Alaska? What's it like in Appalachia? And first, what's it like on the coast of Georgia, in the land of the Gullah Geechee people?
To me, growing up Gullah Geechee is knowing that you'll never know it all, and it's always something new to learn. There is always someone along the path that will take you under their wing and teach you and lead you and guide you. And most of the times, you get the best story around food, around the kitchen. And so I always find myself in someone's kitchen or eating on someone's porch. I love growing up Gullah Geechee. I love it.
That is Helen Ray Ladson, a poet and art activist from the Gullah Geechee community in Brunswick, Georgia. So if you're not familiar, the Gullah Geechee are an African-American people from the coast of the Carolinas all the way down to Florida, and they have really a distinct language and culture that developed as their enslaved ancestors, who came from different parts of West and Central Africa, all commingled on the sea and barrier islands of the Atlantic coast, and over time, they rooted themselves in this place. Matthew Rayford is one of their descendants, a farmer and a chef whose farm is right down the way from Helen Ladson's. He's also the author of a new cookbook whose name means bless and eat. The title is Bress and Yam, Gullah Geechee Recipes from a Sixth Generation Farmer. You know, it's funny. Normally when I speak to chefs, I say, hey, chef, but you're a farmer too. So I don't know if I'd be like, hey, farmer. Hey, chef.
Yeah, chef farmer.
Hey, chef farmer. So chef farmer Matthew, great to talk with you.
Great talking with you too.
Okay, so you, because you're a farmer, you probably know the seasons as much by the land and the feel as what's happening with it more than looking at the calendar. But what is June like for you? Like, what's June look like?
What does June look like? June is where the wild things are. the reason I say that is because there's this spot on the property where wild blackberries are just growing in abundance.
Oh,
and
wow.
If you've never had a blackberry directly off of that prickly, spiny vine that's crawling all over the ground and up on the top of trees, you've never really had a fresh blackberry. I mean, they are just amazing. And so it's very beautiful here. Everything is like in full bloom right now. We're still planting right now also. So, so the month has this like magnificent look to it where you have some plants, like I just spoke about the wild blackberries and some of the wild sumac that's here and mullein, that are in like full growth spurt right now, right? And then I'm growing rice this year, so I have like little small tiny plants out there too. So
just
it's like
shoots.
This, like shoots. Yeah, so we got this real crazy mixture of what the farm looks like, and that doesn't even count the chickens, the hogs, and the ducks.
Oh, right on. Wow, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that I know what it looks like, tell me what summer tastes like for you. I know you're from the Georgia coast. That's where you are right now. But you've spent time in, you know, South Carolina low country, and certainly the Gullah Geechee culture stretches from there down through the Georgia coast.
Mm-hmm.
What summer tastes like in your
heart? Oh, man. I mean, it depends on where you want to start. You want to start with savory or sweet? You tell me.
Well, you really talked about the blackberries.
Okay, so I already talked about the blackberries. So let's go to the savory side. So this time of year is shrimping season. So the Blessing of the Fleet is coming along, or has already come along. There's shrimp boats out on the 3 mile mark. So you're going to have these big, giant, juicy shrimp that come in. Lots of low country boils are about to start happening in this part of the world. Watermelon's already in full swing here.
Come on.
And then tomatoes are coming on right now. Cucumbers are coming on super strong. You know, I know farmers right now that are pulling black radishes out of the ground. Corn is popping up pretty high right now. So we got a little bit of everything going. I mean, I just snapped a picture yesterday of Persian limes that are starting to come off on our trees. So I'm excited.
But you got citrus too?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Low Country Boil, mm-hmm. because I think that is such an iconic and legendary and certainly a well-known dish, but not many people have had a chance to taste the experience of a Low Country Boil. Tell us what your Low Country Boils are like.
So the Low Country Boil that I have now and the Low Country Boil I kind of grew up with is slightly different. And most of it is because when I grew up, you could still harvest a very small amount of turtle eggs. And so turtle eggs would go into the Low Country Boil. So you'd have the turtle eggs, you'd have the shrimp, you'd have crab, you'd have sausage, corn, potatoes, like all that would go into that Low Country Boil.
This is wild. And what's the liquid?
Liquid is water. You know, water and seasoning, you know, whatever seasonings that you have. Now, you can make your own stock and all that kind of stuff, but I mean, you really don't have to because the amount of onions and carrots and all the other stuff that you put in there, it already starts its own thing, right off from the beginning. But when I grew up with all of those things in a Low Country Boil, and it was one pot cookery, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like one pot cookery on like steroids because you had all kind of seafood in there. You got these big old pieces of sausage in there. You got big old giant pieces of corn and then butter just sitting on the sides of the table with big old things of cast iron with cornbread in it. And so it's kind of funny to come back home in like the mid-2000s and like go to some place and get a Low Country Boil. And I go, oh, how come you ain't got no crab in this? Where's the eggs? You know, and they're like, well, we can't do turtle eggs anymore. I said, I know, but you can at least throw in some chicken eggs or some duck eggs or something. So, yeah, I that's the way I ate it.
And this is not talking – we're not talking about like a nice little four-quart stock pot on the stove with this, right?
No. This is like the – it's like the turkey fryer kind of like pot, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, 30 gallons, you know? Like when you did a Low Country Boil, you didn't do it for like, you know, you and one other person. Like you did it for like 20, 30, 40 people, you know? So it was always a big to-do, you know?
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah.
God, that kind of party. I mean, you know, it's been a minute since I've been to anything like that.
So, oh, man, you got to come down here, brother. I got it for you. I'm ready.
Tell us more about shrimp season. I know you have a thing for cocktail sauce.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. So, you know, I grew up eating fresh cocktail sauce. Like, it was kind of funny because when I got to school and, you know, going to CIA, you know, you learn all these, like, little side sauces that you can make and things like that. And I was looking at it like, oh, man, I've been making cocktail sauce since I was like nine. You know, and it was like ketchup, horseradish, you know, lemon, lime juice, whatever we had, you know what I'm saying? Then it was my great-grandfather, and they would like take onions and caramelize them and like cook them down till they were almost starting to fall apart. And they would stir that into that cocktail sauce also. So it always had this like oniony, horseradishy, and then it was always peppers in there, like, and I don't mean like a green pepper. I mean like a pepper, like hot pepper was always in there, like from a little pepper sauce.
I love that because when I think of cocktail sauce, I think, you know, shrimp cocktail, and you think, you know, it's like this sort of like stereotypical, you know, cocktail party. You got the shrimp hanging off the side of the glass.
Yeah, hanging off the side of the glass and all that stuff. Yeah, nah, we're talking Low Country Boil. Let's put it on the table. Like there was always this big thing of butter there, you know, also that was melted, ready to dip into. Yeah, so it's really interesting to grow up in what is considered for me the Deep South. And then, like, my dad was a baker by trade. I don't know if I was ever told you that before. My dad was a baker by trade. So I grew up eating, like, pettifors and apple turnovers made with laminated dough and stuff like that. Because my dad would just, you know, he would, that the night before, he'd start making the laminated dough. And then he'd just, like, the next morning, we'd wake up and it'd be apple turnovers for breakfast, you know? So, yeah, I kind of grew up a lot around food, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And in all different variations, because I think for my family, a lot of it was food connected the community, connected the family, connected everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think my family always looked for a reason to have a party, you know, so they could cook a lot of food. So it was always a big thing to eat, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. But how did you know that the farming life would be the life for you? Because I remember you told me your first job was at a Piggly Wiggly grocery store.
Right, right, right.
And you were like not trying to be on the farm.
No, you know, I didn't even want to be back in the South. Like, for real, for real. I was like, I got to go. I can't do this. You know, this is the 80s, you know, the different kind of South. Like, that South was still reminiscent of the 50s and 60s here in thought process and mannerisms and things like that. And so when I left, I was like, I'm gone. And then my sister and I end up back home 20 years later at a family reunion. And, you know, my Nana, you know, comes to me, and I've told this story quite often, but, you know, it's kind of interesting to, like, really, every time I think about it, it really brings me back home to, like, the trees. Something must have been talking to me when I did this, because the ancestors must have really pulled me in, because, you know, my Nana had been saying for years, baby, what are we going to do with all this land? And I'd always go, y'all got to go back to farming, because that's what y'all know how to do. And for me to sit around with my sister and look over at her and go, should I say it, you know, with that look? And I looked back at my Nana and was like, Nana, we, you know what, we should go back to farming. And she was like, you say we, baby? You know, like, just happy, you know, with this big old grin on her face. Oh, and next thing you know, I'm gift deeded, you know, 15 acres of land. And I was like, I guess y'all better get to farming, you know. And so, but, I, you know, I think it's one of those things, too, right? You know, you're a CIA grad, right? So, and I'm a CIA grad. And, you know, always in class, it was always about the freshest ingredients you can possibly get from the local farmer, if you can get it. You know what I'm saying? Sure. Like, it was always about that. It wasn't about bringing things from thousands of miles away. So being taught that and knowing that, you know, coming back home, it just made it, like, even easier, because I was like, I'm back on this land. I know that blackberry season, I can make blackberry pie. I can make blackberry doobie if I want to, which is basically blackberry dumplings. But, like, physically growing it yourself and then creating something with it on a plate, it just moves the mind into another space, I believe. And I think that that's also what Southern cooking also truly invokes, is the fact that most Southern cooking that I grew up with, people knew where it came from, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I joked with you a while back about the fact that, you know, like, if you were going to be a farmer in the South, in the Deep South, there's a couple of things you had to have by the 4th of July. Corn, tomatoes, and watermelon by the 4th of July. You had to have those three things, or you ain't worth your salt. And so I remember when I came home, you know, folks like, oh, you going to go to farming? I was like, yep, I'm coming back home to farm. Well, you know what you got to have up before 4th of July. And if you don't have it, you know, we're going to be talking about you. And they were literally like, I had some old farmers come out to the farm and was like, you ain't planting no corn. You know, and I was like, I did. I just planted a little bit of it over there. Well, what's your watermelon patch look like? Them tomatoes don't look too good over there. I said, well, those are Cherokee purple tomatoes. They're not, like, just regular. Oh, okay, well, you better, let me taste one of them tomatoes. Let me see what it tastes like, you know. So when I first came home almost a decade ago, I had farmers that were, like, challenging me, you know, and I was like, what is this? You know what I'm saying? It's like walking into a kitchen with, like, your chef mentor, and they go, you don't know nothing about making no beurre blanc, you know, and you're like,
let me see you hold that knife.
Right. Look how you hold that knife. You're going to cut one of your fingers off, you know.
You're a shoemaker?
Yeah, there you go. Cobbler. Yeah.
That's Matthew Rayford, chef, farmer, and author of Bress and Yam. We'll be back with more with Matthew, and then we head north to Alaska. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about June today, how the first calendar days of summer look and taste in three very different parts of the country. Right now, we're on the coast of Georgia with the chef and farmer, Matthew Rayford. Your book starts with this really remarkable fact, that you know your ancestry going back more than six generations to a specific place in Africa.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that is a family history, a personal history that I think most Black Americans don't have of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enslavement divorced them from that history.
So, right.
Like, there was a big line. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know how to cross in terms of their own history.
Right.
So you've been talking about your generations before. I know you learned how to farm your land by, you know, looking back at old letters that your great-grandparents used to send to each other and all that. But how does having that history make you think about what you do? How does knowing that history make you think about what you do?
You know, I feel like you're talking to me like you're my uncle or something. and I also feel like I'm on Spider-Man, you know what I'm saying? With great power comes great responsibility, you know? I'm a Marvel fan too, but and DC Comics. But anyway, I can be both, y'all. I can be both.
Chef, farmer, nerd,
right. But yeah, that's true too. I think I have a responsibility to carry a torch so that the way can stay lit and mm-hmm. that I connect with as many other people that are trying to carry similar torches so that we can end up making it more like a spider's web so that we're connected, you know, and that anything that's happening within the diaspora, we can continue to connect. So to stick to that, you know what I'm saying? And not in a negative light. Like there's been enough, and there will always be talk about the past, right? But I think we have to think about what our past has taught us and how we can apply it to today for like the next couple of generations that are coming up. They got a lot that they're up against right now. You know what I'm saying? And I believe that the more that they know about their past, the more they can help develop or kind of like wave through or move through all the minutiae of just a normal day. And I think knowing like what my great grandparents went through and my great great grandparents went through, and then also understanding that the perseverance that they went through is part of my history also. And that I should be able to learn how to persevere also. And so I want to make sure that I connect other people to that. And, you know, food is a unifying thing, right? I get people at a table, all the things that they talked about negatively before, it just tends to like melt away when they're at a table and they're eating, you know, it becomes a common thing. Right. And so I want to figure out a more equitable footing to get on by using farming and chefing to do that exact same thing. That's my activism. Like I don't necessarily have the political aspirations or anything like that. I want to be active by making sure that people understand how long people have really been composting and that composting isn't brand new. You know, that we've been recycling, farmers themselves just by nature have been recycling since the beginning, you know, because we didn't have all the access to everything. So, yeah.
So it's about getting that strength and wisdom from the past and sending it to the future.
Sending it to the future.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate our time.
Yeah. Have a great summer. It was great to talk with you.
Yeah, definitely.
Matthew Rayford is the author of Bress and Yam, Gullah Geechee Recipes from a Sixth Generation Farmer. You can find his recipe for Blackberry Doobie at splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to go from the absolute summer fecundity of the Georgia soil to drying seaweed for food in Alaska.
My first job when I was little was to keep the dandelion seeds that usually fly around when it's windy. I'd have to pick it out of the seaweed. So I had to go along and pick those out of the seaweed as they're drying. So as I watch the dandelions and they come in, they're nice and bright and yellow. And then within a week or so, they turn to seed. And usually it's a good indication the seaweed's ready.
That's Joel Jackson, a Tlingit elder and the president of the organized village of Cake near Juneau. And our next guest to tell us more about June in Alaska is Melanie Brown, a woman of the Yupik and Unangan people on her mother's side and of the Inupiaq people on her father's. For much of the year, Melanie lives in Juneau, working as an organizer for environmental protection. But every year in June, she goes out almost 1,000 miles west to Bristol Bay, one of the most stunning places on earth, to fish the salmon season with her family on the set net site that her great-grandfather staked out on the Naknek River. Melanie, it's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're so excited to get to talk with you and to hear about your place. So you actually haven't flown out to Bristol Bay for the season yet, but what will you expect it to look like and smell like when you get there?
It's really vividly green. You know, of course, there's so many different greens that you see from the air as you're approaching. And so,
oh, yeah.
There's so much water that moves across the tundra, too. It's not just like the Naknek River as an artery that cuts through the tundra. There are a bunch of sloughs and creeks that flow into the river. And it's really amazing to see the shape of the water and the pothole lakes that rest on the tundra. And then once I actually get to get out on the tundra, it feels like hiking, even though the tundra is pretty flat, because you have to lift your legs so high to step forward because it's so spongy.
Yeah.
And it smells really amazing because of the Labrador tea that's in the tundra, and also the berries that are getting ready. There are blueberries and cranberries and little blackberries called crowberries. And then a clusterberry called cloudberries. The native name is Akpik, and they're all in bloom. And then they're not ripe until after the sockeye are starting to taper down. So the timing is really good for the berries, but it's really wonderful to get out on the tundra and see all the blossoms for the berries that will be coming later in the summer.
Oh, yeah. You know, not knowing the tundra at all, in my mind, tundra is frozen, right? It's covered in snow and ice, and that's what I thought tundra was. And I stupidly, didn't realize, oh yeah, of course, summer. the tundra still experiences summer. And I just remember feeling so enveloped by this just lovely scent. I couldn't place my finger on it. I couldn't say, oh, it's like this or it's like that. It just smelled like the cleanest, sweetest air I'd ever smelled in my entire life. And now that you mention, I remember that feeling of stepping on the tundra and feeling it's like your feet are cushioned with each step. It feels really, I hate to say magical, because it's real life. It's real life for people. But like, coming from where I come from, where this is not something I've ever been exposed to, like, it felt like a magical place.
I think magical is an appropriate word to use. Even though I've spent every summer of my life out there, it's still magical to me, especially to return in the early summer. It really feels like home, even though I'm not there year-round.
Yeah. And the sun, this is when, famously you get sun, 23, 22 hours a day? I remember, I keep talking like, oh, as if I've been there a lot. I've only been there twice. But I remember one time sitting outside on the porch of the lodge where I was staying, reading a book at 1:30 in the morning. As if it was 1:30 in the afternoon. It's an amazing feeling to be there when it's that light for that long. It just feels like the day never ends and it's just endlessly possible.
Yeah, well, that's what makes the tundra sort of explode to life in the summer. It's really cool when you're out on the water and you can see the sun just starting to dip to the horizon and the moon at the same time. That's a really striking view. Once the darkness starts to come back, it's quite a sight.
Wow. Okay, and so let's talk about why you go there. You go there to fish for salmon. And if I'm not mistaken, all of the species of Pacific salmon run in Bristol Bay at one point or another, Chinook or King, Coho, Pink, Chum. But most importantly is the sockeye. Can you tell us about this particular kind of salmon?
Sure. Sockeye salmon, they're also known as red salmon, because when they return to fresh water, their skin turns red, because when they return to their home stream, they're returning to spawn and then die. And when they're ready to spawn and they're driving, they're surging home, with a lot of energy, they stop eating because their sole purpose is to go and procreate and continue their species. And when they stop eating, all of the color that's in their flesh migrates to their skin. So that's why they're called red salmon. At least that's my understanding. But Bristol Bay is a really, it's an especially perfect environment for sockeye salmon because sockeye favor a sort of a flatter gradient of land. You know, land, and the land in Bristol Bay, it rises very slowly out of the water. And the mountains of Bristol Bay are quite far inland. So it's just a really ideal environment for sockeye salmon. And they return in the tens of millions. Last year, over 50 million sockeye salmon returned. And the projections that came out of the University of Washington School of Fisheries and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are anticipating another really strong return of over 50 million again.
And June is when they come back, right? Like this is the time.
That's right. June is when sockeye start rolling in to Bristol Bay. They start showing up around mid-June, but you know, and then there's kind of a bell curve. The numbers start to slowly increase, and then the traditional peak is right around July 4th. And we usually experience a few peaks. But there's always one really big blast that comes through, it seems. And yeah, because they all like to travel together. My understanding is that they travel more efficiently if they're coming in a kind of a big ball. And then they peel off as they arrive to each of their respective river systems. And there are seven major river systems in Bristol Bay.
Wow. And you know, this is a very pretty remote area. There aren't a lot of people here. You know, like the ecosystem is very delicate. It's very much impacted by all these fish. Tell us culturally and traditionally the importance of the sockeye run for your people.
Well, I guess I'd have to say culturally and traditionally, the salmon are everything to the people. Of course, there are other, you know, there are other forms of sustenance outside of salmon, but the thing about salmon is that they provide the majority of food for people of the region, but they also provide sustenance for the land because after they spawn and die, their carcasses fertilize the edge of the riverbanks. And then in turn, the caribou and moose come and browse on the shrubs and trees and tundra that the salmon nurture with their bodies.
Yeah.
It's a really amazing connected cycle of life. But more importantly, going back to your original question, I think that, you know, the people of Bristol Bay, they exist and they are who they are because of salmon. And without the salmon, we wouldn't be who we are. And in many ways, I myself owe my very existence to salmon because I feel like it's the salmon that saved my great grandparents after the great flu that swept through Bristol Bay a century ago. And you know, of course, there's echoes associated with what's happening right now with the pandemic.
Right. But so if we look forward a little bit to the run this year, and you'll be able to fish it with your family. After you've caught the fish, you know, how do you celebrate that harvest? How do you like to eat it? How do you preserve it for the year? Tell us about that.
So it's really nice to have the first taste of fresh salmon every year, of course. My favorite way to prepare it is to just bake it very simply, you know, just open up the salmon and, you know, break it down, cut the head in half, lay it open, and I like to cook the backbone too and just put some, you know, light seasoning on it and bake it at really high heat. And then I also like to preserve the eggs and make caviar or ikara with it and then just put that on everything. So I get, you know.
You do that at home?
Yeah, I do it at home. I use a tennis racket to separate the eggs from the skin and then preserve it in some tamari and with a little bit of mirin and sake. And then I'll put like just a little bit of vinegar to kind of give it a high spike of flavor.
And,
I like to can salmon too. I have not yet learned how to smoke salmon, But that is my, really? I've decided that that's going to be my transition when I retire from fishing, when my body can't handle the work anymore. I really want to transition to making traditional style dried and smoked salmon. It takes 28 days. The cycle of it is 4 weeks from the time that you start hanging it and drying it and exposing it to smoke. And that's something that there's no way I could do that while I'm commercial fishing, because when I'm commercial fishing, it's such an intense period of work. But I think I still have a few more years of fishing in me.
And now when you go out to fish, you fish with your children too, right?
That's right. I have a daughter and a son, and my daughter, she's been a full-fledged crew member for the past few years, and I eased her in bit slowly. She's 19 now, but I kind of eased her in slowly from the time that she was about 12 or so. She started coming out on the day tides, and then eventually she started coming out for every tide. And she's really great in the boat. She's really steady, and you know, she just plugs away, and she has a very even temper, and it's a pleasure being in the boat with her. And my son, he's still transitioning into being a full-fledged crew member, but the last summer that he fished, he really was chipping in quite a lot and really, you know, working hard. So I think this summer he'll probably take another big step forward and being a full-fledged crew member.
Oh, lovely. How does it feel?
Wonderful.
How does it feel to be on a boat, on the water, and a set net site that your ancestors laid, and to be there with your children?
I'm really proud to be there with my children. It really is a good feeling. And it's nice to know that I'm carrying on what my great-grandfather started. He was still fishing when I started fishing, so I got to work beside him when I was small. And it's really nice having those memories. And I've fished with my mother for years now, and so it's definitely a family affair.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I hope you have a wonderful season. It was great to talk with you, Melanie. Thanks so much.
Great to talk with you too. Thank you so much.
Melanie Brown is a fourth-generation fisherwoman and is also an organizer at Salmon State in Alaska. Coming up, June in Appalachia. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. This episode, we're traveling across the country to find out what the early days of summer look like in very different parts of America. Our next region is one that's near and dear to my heart, Appalachia. I've never lived there, but I did have the extraordinary pleasure of editing one of the finest cookbooks, really maybe one of the finest books written on the place, Vittles by Ronnie Lundy. For the months that I worked on that book, I lived in my mind in its history and its future, and how unique a place it is, because, you know, the old ways of gardening and farming never really left. Well, the people don't really have to relearn or rediscover how their grandparents did things, because the family garden and the family seeds never went away. Here's the farmer Mike Costello of Lost Creek Farm talking about the way he sees spring turn into summer.
June is kind of a beautiful time because late May sort of kicks off what, at least in my family, was kind of outdoor picnic season. You know, so it was like Memorial Day weekend. It used to be known as Decoration Day weekend. And the tradition was to go to the cemetery and have a picnic with your family and decorate graves, but also experience this fellowship and this food. And my mom always talked about that experience as sort of almost being like a little bit of a county fair atmosphere, because everyone brought, you know, these pickles and these preserves. She always says it was just a little bit competitive, you know, because everybody wanted to show off, you know, the best, who had the best, you know, chow chow, or who had the best bread and butter pickles.
So yeah, I want to see what a friendly neighborhood game of who's got the best chow chow looks like. My next guest is the person who introduced Mike to us, my friend and hero, Ronnie Lundy. Hey, Ronnie.
Hi, Francis.
Oh, it's so good to talk with you.
Oh, it's wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. I'm okay. It's starting to get warm.
Yes.
It's really nice. And that's what brings us here today, because we want to talk about summer in Appalachia. So maybe I'll just start with a very simple question. And that is, what does June look like to you up in the mountains?
Oh, wow. Well,
paint a picture for us.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any problem at all. I am actually facing a huge window, and outside of it, everything is already green. And June is so bright. And I was thinking about how the first taste of summer are also so bright. It's kind of like, imagine you're a mountain bear and you're coming out of your hibernation cave into that sunlight, and you love it, but you also kind of have to squint, you know? And so the first foods we start eating are tart like that. They're still radishes from spring, but we start getting rhubarb and we start getting wild strawberries, which are tiny and just like so intense. And then regular strawberries, which are still really tart. So it's everything, both the taste and even the sounds of the season, because the birds are all coming back. And, you know, you haven't been hearing this, and you just suddenly hear all these sharp high notes. Outside of my yard, there's an old tree stump, and I have this amazing redheaded woodpecker family that apparently is going to raise their young here, because Papa was out there hammering away at the tree stump, coming up with some grub for the family.
That is the most lovely scene. I have to admit, when I asked you the question, in my head, I was thinking about, like, getting in a car and driving down and getting a hot dog and a chili bun somewhere for some reason, like when I think of summer.
Well, that is so great that you just said that. you're being very cosmic there to have said that, because so I live right now in Western North Carolina, and I'm not too far from the Tennessee border, and you can get chili dogs in Western North Carolina, but the chili bun, which is a part of the really railroad towns in coal country. So the first chili bun I can get is in Irwin, Tennessee. And I'm actually heading up there on Monday. And the perk of my trip is I've promised myself a chili bun. So you're right, Francis. It is. It is this wonderful thing that starts the season.
And so a chili bun, just for folks who don't know, is a chili dog, but without the dog, right? So it's the chili sauce.
And chili bun chili is usually a little spicier than your standard hot dog chili.
Can you tell us, why is there this obsession with chili dogs and chili buns?
Because they taste good.
I mean, aside from them being delicious, yeah.
I mean, they are also a regional signifier. You know, I grew up eating chili buns from Corbin, Kentucky, and there were three iconic places, and they're all pool rooms in railroad towns. So we don't really understand the origins. I mean, we don't have the Ur story of who made the first chili bun and why, although there's some interesting speculation. So it was like this really fast, easy snack that you could eat between games or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the men who went to pool rooms started bringing them home to their families. I kind of wonder if it served the same purpose as, you know, I think there's this story about yakinane in New Orleans, that men would bring that home after they'd been out too late to kind of appease their wives.
Yeah, it was like the drunk food noodles.
Yeah, those Appalachian pool players were bringing that home.
Daddy's been out drinking and gambling, but I brought home dinner.
So they're also a super tangy, bright food. You put yellow ballpark mustard and chopped up white onion on them. So the Dixie was the pool hall from my childhood, but there was another one called the Fad that was said to have had better chili buns. But the ultimate chili bun was made at a place called Neville's that was gone by the time I came along. But my mother always said Neville's would make the sweat break out on the top of your lip. And even using New Mexico red chili and having spent time in New Mexico, I never achieved that.
All right, so now that we have covered the chili bun, what really screams Appalachian summer to you?
a long table that has about a dozen different dishes involving fresh vegetables and maybe one platter devoted to fried chicken, but not necessarily. Really, the main course of the summer table would be one of the crazy number of varieties of green beans that we grow. Some of them are named after people. Some of them have names. There are a lot of turkey craw or crow beans that supposedly the seed bean was found in the craw of one of those birds some point. All good beans have strings on the side of them, and all beans have beans inside them. We don't eat grass and call it a green bean down here, right?
No judgment. Huh?
No, I know. Like I said, I'm very mellow about these things.
So how do you cook these green beans?
Low and slow.
Okay.
You're actually braising them. And people, when they talk about green beans, they'd say, we cook them to death, or that we overcook them. But the fact of the matter is what we're doing is we're cooking that bean inside. And if you don't cook that bean, it doesn't release the protein and the amino acids, et cetera, that help you absorb it. So we cook it usually with some sort of bacon seasoning. For green beans, my mother always said you used white bacon, but you could use ham hock or any kind of pork. And now when I want to do a vegetarian version of it, I use olive oil and smoked Spanish paprika. Our Spanish smoked paprika. I can't remember which one my editor told me was correct. Can you?
I leave that to the copy editors.
Okay. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And you bring that to a boil, and then you turn it low, and you basically are braising them. You know, it's very easy to see that this is a French method and to call it that, and then people respect it a little more until the bean inside gets tender, and then the outside of the bean has almost a velvety texture. And then in a minute, we'll probably talk about shuck beans or leather breeches, which is a dried version of this bean. And when you're cooking those, that outside of the bean gets like silk.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how we would cook them here. And you'd serve them with cornbread. And when you put the corn and the beans together, you're creating the first step of a whole protein. And then if you add some dairy to that. And we often drank cold milk with a meal in the summer. And you would always have a raw onion with that. And then you would have whatever had come out of that garden. So hopefully it would be fresh corn that you'd cut off the cob and you cook it in a skillet. And this is getting after the June bright burst of flavors. Mm-hmm. You're getting into what I call the unctuous summer, right? Where things get, they're just so rich and creamy and silky. So you would be cutting the corn off and cooking it in bacon grease or butter with milk added to it. And it's just delicious. It's so good. Salt and pepper, plenty of salt and pepper.
Oh, that fried corn sounds so good.
And you'd have those incredibly ripe tomatoes, and you would have summer squash, which when you cook it becomes so juicy and delicious. You usually have some kind of casserole with that. And peaches would be appearing on the table. You might even still be opening up a couple of cans of spiced peaches that you'd put away. And cucumbers.
Oh
my gosh.
Yeah.
A gazillion cucumbers. Yeah.
Well, actually, you've mentioned a couple of things now. You mentioned spiced peaches on the table. And you mentioned drying the green beans that you talked about so beautifully. So there is this pretty unique tradition of preservation in Appalachian cooking. And of course, like pretty much every culinary culture involves some form of preservation for obvious reasons. People need food year round. If you're not in a place where, you know, food grows year round, you got to keep it. But the dry beans, the leather breeches, tell us about that tradition.
Sure. You know, a lot of times people say to me, well, what distinguishes Appalachian cooking? And so the shorthand that I tell people is that it's Southern cooking, Southern food, but unlike the deeper South, you have to plan for and deal with a very intense winter. mm-hmm. so that we have to do some pretty intensive planting in gardens in the summer. And just as things start to come in, we have to start not only cooking for supper that night, but preparing the foods for meals all through the winter. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned shuck beans are leather breeches, and those are the same green beans I'm talking about, pole beans, that you have to pull the side strings off of. And then instead of breaking them up and throwing them in a pot, you would sew them up on thread. You would push a needle through the bean and drag the thread through. And it would be like, if you've ever been in the Southwest and you've seen a ristra, a chili ristra, this would be like a bean ristra, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And you hang them someplace. In days when you would have a wood stove, a lot of times it would be behind the stove or in the attic, and they dry up. And then you eat them in the winter. They were often a traditional New Year's dish, or they might appear as a treat for Christmas. So that's one of the traditions. Another tradition in the mountains is drying apples. And that starts in June. So we would start drying apples, and there are all those varieties of apples. We dry apples right up into the fall. And if you're good at cutting them in a round that stays round, you could actually string them up or put them on a broomstick.
You can
core them out, right? You can put a sheet on a table and lay them on the table. Or I think the best method is that you get a really good old screen door and you wash it down good so it's good and clean. And then you put it up in the attic or someplace dry and you lay the apples out on it. If you lay them on the sheet, you have to turn them. But if you put them on the screen and you set that up, the air is on both sides. And a lot of places dry apples, but the distinctly Appalachian thing you do with them is that you make this cake that is specific to the region that has anywhere from 5 to 8 really thin layers that are not quite cake and not quite biscuit. They're somewhere sort of in between. And then you cook down the dried apples with some sorghum syrup, and they become like a almost like a mush. And you put that between the layers and you wrap it up, and it sits for about 3 days. And then when you cut into it, the apples have permeated the cake. And again, another thing that's only done in Appalachia. And then the other thing that's pretty regional is something called pickle beans or sour corn. Or sour beans or pickle corn, just depending on who your grandmother was. But this is not pickling like putting something in a jar with a vinegar, sugar, salt and herb mixture, you know, kind of thing. This is pickling in a crock like you make sauerkraut.
Okay.
And
you salt it and then it sits in it.
And so you do those green beans just like you were going to cook them. You string them, you break them up, but you throw them in a crock with salt. You do the same thing. You cut corn off the cob, you put it in a crock, and you salt it down, and you set it aside, and you let it ferment so that what you get is a fermented food like a kraut, like a kimchi without the spices. And, you know, it's not served like a pickle. It's not a relish. These things are your main dish in the winter.
Oh, wow.
And depending on your family's tolerance for salt, you either use it straight or you rinse it off, and then you cook it in a skillet in bacon grease enough to warm it up and to brown the corn a little. And that's your main course for a winter supper. And, you know, I talk about this, how there's such a thing as Appalachian umami. And it's not only that sort of rich taste because of the bacon in the cooking, but it also has an element of salt and an element of something very acidic, like a wang to it is what my mother says, right?
A wang. And you only get that by prepping it, you know, 3 months earlier than when you're going to eat it. So,
yeah.
I mean, June definitely sounds, or summer definitely sounds like a busy time for you.
It's incredibly busy when you're in the mountains. If you're going to live through the winter, you know.
If you want to live.
If you want to live, this is what you do, kids.
All right, Ronnie. Well, I wish you a wonderful summer drying apples, getting ready for your snack cakes.
Oh, thank you.
This has been so fun to talk with you.
Well, I think you better come down and sit on the porch and I'll feed you some of this, okay?
One day.
All right.
One day.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks so much, Ronnie.
You bet. Bye.
Ronnie Lundy is the author of the 2017 James Beard Book of the Year, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. You can find her recipe for ginger bean chow chow at splendidtable.org, and maybe you'll have the best chow chow in your neighborhood this year. Well, that's our show for this week, and I hope you take some time today to take a look around you a little bit, and take a deep breath, and see and smell and taste what June is like wherever you are. We'll talk to you next week. You know, you can take our past episodes on your walks or in your car. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.